The title is Location, Timing, and Mobility, Parasitoids in Space.
The little one's back. That's forward.
Oh, that's
okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. I really want to take a moment to thank everyone who's organized this conference. It's such a unique opportunity to actually learn about what all these great people that we're surrounded with all the time are doing and have been doing, and it's really... I find that these guys, they're a really hard act to follow. But I'm also like extremely moved and proud of everything you guys have done. So I'm going to talk about the work that I've been doing in the last 5 years in Steve Welter's lab here in the Organisms and Environment Division, and try to summarize from sort of a bigger picture perspective if I can. So by way of an introduction, I'll give a little bit of background about what motivated me to do this work and what my principal interests were. And then talk a little bit about the system, which is right here in our own backyard. So we're going to bring it back to California. And then the focus of my research and sort of the science tools that I've taken advantage of, and the approach, all the findings and the data I'll summarize quickly, and then some of the conclusions thus far. So this really fits, the work that I've been doing really fits in nicely with what we heard about this morning of ecosystem services, and in particular, pest control. And I like to think of ecosystem services like that, you know, great friend who was always around for you and always did all these nice things for you, and then they move out of town and all of a sudden you realize, my friend's gone, you know. So it's kind of, you don't really know, it seems like we don't really know as sort of a general society about these great things until they're gone. And so we're kind of scrambling in the last minute to put together as much information as we can about these really important ecological services. And pest control is one of them. And in California, as we all know, we produce the vast majority of the food, the fresh produce for the country and for a large part of the world. So pest control is important right here in our own backyard. There's a few different types of natural enemies. We call natural enemies our natural friends. They're basically attacking our competitors. And we define pests, you know, pests are defined sort of, what's the word for it, relatively. So pests just means that they're competing with us for what we like to eat. And there's predators and parasites and pathogens of pest species. And I focused on what I think is the coolest of those words, which is parasitoids. Basically because it ends in OIDS. So if you're going to spend 5 years studying something, it should end in OIDS. And they're basically, it's a lifestyle. So they're taxonomically diverse, but they all have a very disgusting strategy of life, which is that they actually lay their eggs in or on a host, and then either immediately or over the course of time, kill that host. And they're just beautiful and incredibly diverse. It's really easy to, people say that you start looking like your organism that you study. It's really easy to imagine that in this case. Another reason they're interesting from sort of a theoretical perspective is that they're sort of the flagship example of this co-evolutionary theory. The Red Queen hypothesis sort of gets at this idea that you're really only running away in order to chase. And so over evolutionary time, parasitoids and their host are really in this sort of Cold War arms race, just, you know, bringing the ante up a little bit over time and evolving over time ways to get around what their host has figured out, or, well, that's not a good way to put it, but what their host has done to evade them. Another interesting instance of co-evolution is actually what we've done with plants in domesticating plants for our own purposes. So in North America, humans in North America have domesticated several important plants like corn and squash and beans. And another example of that is sunflower. And here you see agricultural sunflowers and their relative, same species, their wild relative, Helianthus annuus, the wild sunflower. So this is the system that I've been working in and really have enjoyed Here's California, and it's a little hard to see in this lighting, but the yellow areas that I sort of airbrushed are areas where typically every summer growers plant sunflowers for developing varieties that are then grown in the Midwest. So we're really a parent seed material state. We grow a lot of sunflower for the purposes of providing the rest of the country with seed material. And it's becoming a very increasingly important economic sector, sort of secondary crop. The green areas there, and you might, if you travel to LA, you might recognize that as Highway 5 and Highway 99. Those are areas where we typically every summer see these wild relatives of the crop sunflower popping up. And there's one very prolific herbivore that eats the seeds and parts of the flowers called the sunflower moth, which is the most important economic pest of sunflower. And it's also found, of course, on the wild variety. So I became very interested in Steve's lab in the past has also looked at the system in this idea that we have an herbivore that has co-evolved, we assume co-evolved with this plant in North America for eons, and then the plant has been changed by human selection, largely actually in Europe and Russia is where they really developed sunflower varieties, and then it was reintroduced into this area and planted very widely, and you have these wild systems or self-seeding sunflower systems growing sympatrically with these agricultural systems, and the insects are moving back and forth. Now, some insects are doing so very successfully, and an example of that is the sunflower moth, and some insects are not as successful. And as it turns out, a lot of the insects that control the sunflower moth populations in the wild settings are not making their way into the agricultural settings, and this translates into an economic problem. Oh, so I should just really quickly point out, as you can see, there's six different species of parasitoids in the agricultural sunflower fields, and a total of 14 different species in the wild fields. So I asked sort of three types of questions about this system. I wanted to know how the location of a wild or an agricultural sunflower field impacts the parasitoids that are able to do their work there. I also asked how the timing of the blooming of the sunflowers impacts who's able to, the parasitoids that are able to come in and do their work there. Then I also wanted to know how much they're able to move between systems and just in general, because they're such small species, we don't really know a lot about how much they can move. And so I wanted to know a little bit more about that. And all of that really relates to the number of species of parasitoids at a particular site, the impact, so the total parasitism, how much are they really regulating that moth, and then also the importance of this, the ones that are specialized or very tightly co-evolved versus the ones that are generalist and they're kind of cafeteria parasitoids. They sort of hit whoever they can. And from the theory perspective, I've really looked at sort of landscape and community ecology and trying to scale up what we know about the wild habitat and the ag habitat and trying to think about the bigger scale and also the population dynamics, the host populations. We know there's quite a bit of theory and modeling in this field, a little less sort of like on the ground empirical work. And then looking at the factors that might influence parasitoids. So we do know quite a bit about the local host patch, so sort of the density of parasitoids and or of hosts and how that impacts their parasitoids, and then how timing influences and how gene flow or movement of the parasitoids can influence their impact. So just to summarize some of the findings at the plant and habitat level, in our lab, Yolanda Chen and Steve Welter have looked at wild versus agricultural settings sort of at the patch level or at the field level and found that there's a higher species richness. Obviously, you saw that. There's more specialist and overall parasitism is much higher. And then we looked at a whole set of variables from the landscape perspective and found that these three, orchards, riparian habitat, and annual crops, actually did impact the parasitoids that showed up. So just to summarize that briefly, the proximity to orchards, so this blue bar represents sites that are between 0 and 1,000 meters from orchards, and the green bar represents sites that are further than 1,000 meters. So as you can see, the number of species is really pretty different. And that is actually due mainly to this, to one of the generalist parasitoids that shows up quite a bit, who also is a really important parasitoid of other agricultural pests in orchards. And then the riparian effect is due to this. Did I skip a slide? Sorry about that. Yeah, so there's the orchards. There's the riparian habitat. So here it's a percent parasitism. As you can see, the percent parasitism overall is higher in sites where, and these are all agricultural sites, in sites that are closer to riparian habitat. And based on what we've seen, my guess is that that's due to this specialist parasitoid and some resources that are available for the parasitoid in that riparian habitat. And then the other set of questions about timing, I really don't have time to go into a lot of detail. It's actually a really noisy data set because I looked at all of 35 different sites once a week, every week for these four growing seasons, and have quite a bit of sort of different results from year to year. So I'm still trying to make sense of some of that. But I do see parasitism increasing towards the end of the season, which from a management perspective doesn't really help a lot because they're sort of avoiding sunflower moth by planting earlier in the season. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. I think there's probably some really interesting timing patterns that we still have to get at. But finally, we did look at the specialist parasitoid in terms of mobility, and we used genetic markers to do that. And we asked the question, does this parasitoid specialize, or does it have a population structure at the habitat type? So do we see this parasitoid focusing on one or the other? And the answer is basically no. The 12 microsatellite markers that we used showed pretty much no signal at all of population structure. We did see a structure from California to other parts of the country, but we're basically looking at a really broadly moving and mixing population. So just to summarize everything up, we did find that landscape indicators are important for these parasitoid community parameters. It's still unclear, still a lot of teasing to do, and the management aspects of that are still unclear. Temporal variability is really high, so there's obviously a lot of different influences on parasitoid communities, and gene flow is very high among parasitoids. And I wanted to talk a little bit about management practices. Some of this information ideally would lead to understanding how to manage landscapes and how to plant habitat that can improve the chances of natural enemies, specifically parasitoids, establishing populations. And I just want to say thank you to everyone that's here listening and to all the people that have really been a great support team. My parents are here. And I'll take three questions. No, I'm just kidding. Yes.
How do you see that conflict between the increase in parasitoids for ranching areas, but also getting water that would potentially go to the crop? I mean, our advantage of dealing with that, or how is that kind of perception playing out?
Yeah, the biology and sort of the needs of parasitoids, there's so many different variables that we haven't looked at, but it would be really nice to find sort of some clear patterns of, you know, certain species and certain resources, and that's sort of what we were looking for in the data and still haven't found direct. But from a management perspective, it's not a really clear, there's not a really clear recommendation right now as to resources. Yes.
So you're talking about the diversity of parasitoids being higher in certain places. Have you actually evaluated how many of those are actually attached to the moth?
Are actually what?
Are actually attached to the sunflower
moth? Yeah. So all of those parasitoids were, I didn't get to this, but the way I actually evaluated parasitism was I put out what I call sentinel larvae that we rear in the lab into these sites for known periods of time, and then I retrieve them and rear them in separate little diet cups and identify the parasitoids that emerge just from that species. So those were all actual cases of parasitism by those species. Yeah. But one of the interesting questions, sort of the diversity, the species richness does not necessarily translate into higher rates of parasitism, if that's sort of what you were getting at. Yes, Chris.
Any idea what the
You know, there's a lot of, there's some theory, especially from Europe, looking at riparian areas and parasitoids and provisioning adult resources, things like extra floral nectaries, you know, sort of the imagining that a lot of these native parasitoids likely have relationships with native plants, and the native plants being, you know, more common in riparian areas. Sorry.
You mentioned that flowers are actually planted earlier to avoid the moth, which might actually affect the population of parasitoids. And I'm wondering what sort of dissemination of your research is happening to farmers to communicate that information to parents should be valued.
Yeah, that part's quite challenging. I think we had that media class together. Yeah. So, you know, the spraying in sunflower in California is increasing every year. Pyrethroids might primarily. And I haven't really converted any farmers yet.